The Service to America medals honor federal employees who go above and beyond their job descriptions to serve the public. And for the next few months and past couple of months, we've been speaking to those finalists. When the Justice Department has a big case before the Supreme Court, there's one man it turns to over and over again. Ed Needler has argued 125 cases before the High Court. That's a record among today's lawyers. He's defended the government's positions in the Affordable Care Act, on a controversial Arizona immigration law, and even in the Elian Gonzalez case during the Clinton administration. Deputy Solicitor General Needler joins us now. Ed, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so I think the thing people wonder the most is, on the day you're about to argue a case before the Supreme Court, what's your ritual? Do you, like, stand on your head for an hour, or do you do yoga, or what do you do?
I have prepared before then a list of questions that I anticipate and then boil it down to sort of basic points that I feel like I need to get across no matter what happens. Arguing in the court can be a challenge because you get questions from every direction, and so I have to bear in mind the 2, 3, 4 points that I feel are essential, and then I feel part of my morning by drilling those things into my mind so that they are there, and recounting certain sentences or phrases or ways of putting things that I've developed over the, you know, the preceding week or two of leading up to the argument.
So it sounds like what you do is far more logical than we hear about from some star athletes who are on winning streaks then.
I guess that's correct. I mean, the oral argument in the court is really just the culmination of an enormous preparation time, and all of it is preceded by drafting the briefs that are filed in the court, and that's where you really work out the details of the arguments. And in most cases, we are defending positions that were arrived at earlier in the lower courts, or the government agencies have taken positions that we're defending, but in the Supreme Court, we have to put together a written explanation, a written brief. And so a lot of the issues get worked out there. And it can be a very rigorously analytical task. And often there's history involved. If you have constitutional questions, you're going back to the framing of the Constitution often, or the early cases interpreting it. So all of that is the foundation on which the oral argument in the court rests, and the oral argument and the preparation for it are really a distillation of all of that into the what you think would be the most effective summary points or thematic points.
So at what point in a case's life does it come to you?
Well, it can come at several stages. Our office is responsible for presenting cases in the Supreme Court, but the Solicitor General also has to decide whether the government will appeal a case that it has lost in a trial court. No case can be appealed by the government without the SG's approval, and so often a case will first come to me if we've lost the case, for example, making a recommendation to the Solicitor General on whether to appeal. So I often will have seen the case or seen the issue in a comparable case earlier on, but not always. A lot of times, particularly in cases in which the United States is not a party, we come in as a friend of the court, and in that situation, we really dig into the case for the first time after the Supreme Court has granted review. So it does vary. Sometimes it's brand new, and we have to develop the government's position and get input from a variety of agencies very quickly in order to be able to file a brief and then participate in argument in the case.
Now, working for the government, do you have to argue whatever case they present you as part of your workload? I mean, to say, have you ever disagreed with the government's position and said, this is not the best case for me? Is that something that a Solicitor General can do?
Yes. Well, the attorneys in the Solicitor General's office can do it. The Solicitor General is responsible for defending the government's position, and I suppose that that's most prominently on display when there's the constitutionality of an act of Congress presented. The Solicitor General defends a statute if reasonable arguments can be made on behalf of it. I mean, we are lawyers for a client, and therefore our job is to defend the government's position within very firm duties of candor and all of that, but which is important because it's the right thing for the government, and it's also the right thing in presenting a case to the court. So as an institution, the office represents the client's position, but not always. The Solicitor General makes, unlike a private attorney-client relationship, the Solicitor General decides what cases we will take to the court, not the client, and what arguments to be presented. Obviously, we consult very closely with the agencies, so there is that degree of flexibility in that the Solicitor General makes the ultimate call. Now, within that, individual attorneys, if they have moral objections to a particular position, or if they just believe an argument is wrong, we have a long tradition of a person being able to say no to a particular assignment. So, and that comes up. We have people who have different views on abortion issues or capital punishment, and it can choose not to work on a case.
So tell us about, and I should say we're speaking with Deputy Solicitor General Ed Kneedler. What was the first case that you argued before the Supreme Court?
A case called United States versus Bailey. This was in 1979. It involved a conviction or a conviction for escaping from prison, and the argument was a defense to that. The prisoners were saying, it was a legal defense of necessity or duress. They were claiming that the prison conditions were so bad that it was intolerable and they were excused from escaping from prison. And you can imagine that argument, if taken too far, would create a lot of problems with controlling prison. So we had developed an argument that even if that's true, you have to turn yourself in after you've escaped the intolerable conditions. It was a case, because I was new to the office, I had not written the brief, and I was not a criminal law expert, and there was an enormous factual record in the case, so it was quite a challenge for the first argument.
And what is it like in a Supreme Court session? Is there a high degree of formality, or the different justices have different styles in the way they fire questions at people? What are you standing the whole time? How does it work?
Well, I'm standing when there's a podium right in front of the court. It's actually quite intimate. I'm guessing 10, 12 feet in front of the Chief Justice, and the justices are sort of arrayed to the right and left as he's sitting there. And when you're arguing, you're standing at the podium, and you're very much on your own at that point, although I'm also very aware of all the support that I've gotten along the way from the agencies and others in the department in preparing the case. And I feel like I'm representing them and supporting them. But yes, there is a high degree of formality. The government lawyers, for example, typically wear a morning suit, a formal wear. That's a tradition from ancient days. There is a formality, but the arguments can be very challenging, as I said before, because you can get questions constantly and from different directions and sometimes interrupted, and so you have to try to be nimble on your feet.
And what about the opposing lawyers? Is there one that stands out in your mind over the years as the most difficult or the most colorful or flamboyant or hard to deal with?
I've been up against some really terrific lawyers over the years. I mean, really, in some ways, too many to count. But Ted Olson, who was a former Solicitor General, and Seth Waxman and Paul Clement, all former Solicitors General, for example, I've been up against them. Greg Garr as well, and particularly the lawyers who have appeared before the court a number of times, we're familiar with each other, we know each other, and I think because of the nature of the court and the clerk's office is very helpful in assisting lawyers, there really isn't the contention between lawyers that sometimes you imagine in trial courts, for example. The lawyers tend to be very collegial with each other and very cooperative.
So how would you say, since 1979 in that Bailey case, the practice of arguing before the Supreme Court has changed?
I think it's changed the most in terms of the numbers of questions that you get. When I first went there, you could expect to have a couple of minutes to open your argument, and you could expect to say the equivalent of a paragraph or two, perhaps, during the argument without being interrupted. And so you could craft sort of a presentation and sometimes almost a speech. Now that's not really true. You can expect to be interrupted with questions often within the first minute. And now most justices ask a number of questions. When I first came, the majority of the justices didn't ask many at all. Now, it can be difficult because you get so many questions and you don't always get to complete a thought. On the other hand, having to stand up and just make a speech without being asked is also difficult because you don't know whether people are listening or paying attention. And in the end, if the justices have questions or difficulties with your position, it's best to know that and be able to give the best answers that you can. We have a very rigorous moot court practice. We do two practice arguments before every real argument, and we get peppered with questions, and then part of the responsibility of our colleagues who participate in that is to, after tearing the person down, to build the person up and say, okay, here's the way I would answer that question. And so you come in, you know, prepared in that way as best you can.
Is it true that Justice Thomas never asks a question, or just not that often?
I don't keep track exactly. I would say certainly not that often. It has been several years since he has asked a question, I think maybe five or six.
And I guess among the bar, you are seen as the elder statesman nowadays with so many cases under your belt. What's the number one question you get from other attorneys, and what's the answer you give them?
The number one question?
Yeah, they must want to know what your secret is.
I guess the question I get the most is two, I guess. One, do you still get nervous? And two, how do you prepare? On the first, do I still get nervous? You bet. it is a daunting thing to argue a case in the Supreme Court. And frankly, I don't consider myself a natural at it. There are a lot of people. Or a number of people and who do this, who I do consider naturals, and so it is. I'm a natural introvert. You know, I have to pep myself up. But if I didn't get nervous, if I didn't have the adrenaline, then I probably shouldn't be doing the job, because there is a way of, you know, you should be up to your peak performance. Just like you said, an athlete, obviously it's different than athletics, but you psych yourself up because it is a loaded moment and you want to be able to do your best. In terms of getting ready for the argument, I mean, I have a very, I guess, elaborate process, most of which I've touched on here, in terms of how we develop our positions. It can be fairly bureaucratic because we get recommendations from the agencies and other parts of the Justice Department and then the attorneys in our office. And I feel for this recognition here, that this is really a recognition for our office and for the Justice Department and for other government attorneys, because we get a lot of cooperation and support. So what I finally present is really a distillation of all of those ideas. And then we go through the moot courts that I mentioned when the argument is coming up.
And you absolutely don't have a lucky tie?
I don't have a lucky tie, no. I don't have a lucky tie. I have cufflinks that I wear to every argument. They were they belonged to my grandfather, who was a 40-year public servant school teacher. I wear them. I wouldn't say they're always lucky because I lose a lot of cases, but they give me strength. Let's put it that way.
I'm sure your grandfather would be very happy to know that as well. We've been speaking with Deputy Solicitor General Ed Kneedler. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you.